It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why our guest is counting the days until we can put election season behind us.
First, the Senate race in Wisconsin between incumbent Republican Ron Johnson and Democratic challenger Russ Feingold is getting more national attention. Millions of dollars in the form of TV ads are pouring into Wisconsin as political action committees supporting the candidates try to sway the election next week. Here's a few examples of the ads airing now.
Terrorist attacks in California, a nightclub in Florida, a mall in Minnesota. The threat is real. Yet Russ Feingold supports the deal that gave Iran billions. Billions, even John Kerry admits, will fund terrorism.
My opponent backs bad trade deals that export jobs and billion-dollar tax loopholes for big corporations. I'm going to close those loopholes and help small businesses in Wisconsin grow and create jobs.
Russ Feingold will keep drowning us in the Obamacare disaster. Higher costs, lost coverage, lost doctors.
6 years ago, Ron Johnson sold us a bill of goods.
I'm not a politician.
But then Senator Johnson gave himself a $10 million corporate payout, went to Washington, and never looked back.
Susan Johnson joins us now to talk about these ads and the Senate race 1 week out from the election. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So we're seeing a lot of money being put in on both sides for both candidates here in Wisconsin, where there was a thought that maybe Russ Feingold had too big a lead. Why are we seeing so much money in the 11th hour here?
Well, if you look at some of the polling through October and even before then, Russ Feingold has had and held a lead, but it hasn't been that substantial. So my assumption is that in terms of the Johnson campaign or the Senate Republican campaign organization, they must have some internal polling that indicates that the race is fairly close and winnable, and therefore there's money being put into it from, as you mentioned in the introduction, several different political action committees.
Do these kind of ads, especially with just a week or so to go till the election, do they make a difference?
Well, it's interesting because with early voting and absentee voting and things like that, we see that many people cast their ballots even before Election Day. On the other hand, there are voters who would say they're undecided or haven't been paying as much attention to the Senate race because perhaps they've been paying more attention to the presidential race. And so I think that the goal would be to convince people who maybe are on the fence or people who perhaps are we're not planning on voting to make sure they come out and vote in that Senate election.
Let's look at the presidential coattails here a little bit. There was concern as Donald Trump was polling poorly earlier, just a couple of weeks ago, really, that he might be a drag on key Senate candidates around the country like Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson will now be appearing with Donald Trump for the first time in a visit to Wisconsin, a Donald Trump visit to Wisconsin. Is there some benefit for Ron Johnson of appearing with Donald Trump?
Well, Ron Johnson had been one of those who had kept Donald Trump at arm's length. And I think that perhaps given the events in the presidential election that happened with FBI Director Comey's letter to Congress on Friday, that perhaps people are seeing an uptick in support or a hopeful uptick in support for Donald Trump. And Ron Johnson doesn't see as many negatives as there were before if he's going to be appearing with him.
And how about those the Comey announcement, the emails, Hillary Clinton's campaign? Is that something that might be a drag for a Democratic Senate candidate like Russ Feingold?
Potentially, but I'm not sure that it will be for Feingold specifically. I mean, I think that if this depresses turnout, as is what a lot of Democrats are concerned about, that it could perhaps be a drag for some Senate candidates. But Russ Feingold has a lot of support within the state of Wisconsin, and because he's running to reclaim his seat, I would almost think that there's a lot of people in the state, Democrats in the state, who are more motivated to vote for him than they actually are for Hillary Clinton.
Talking to Susan Johnson, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, a flurry, an upsurge in spending in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race a week out from the election, looking at what's going on between now and then. Let's put this in national context, Susan. How important is this seat for Democratic efforts to turn the Senate Democratic, Republican efforts to keep their majority?
It's very important. The Senate right now currently has a Republican majority, as we know, and the Democrats have their sights on taking over that majority, and they would need 4 seats to do that if Hillary Clinton wins the election and 5 if Donald Trump won, because the vice president would be the tiebreaker in a 50-50 Senate. And so the Democrats are looking to win Wisconsin. That's one of the states that I think they had in their must-win category, and I think that that might be why the Democrats are also putting some money into campaign ads this week to shore up what they see as their advantage in the state.
Let's talk about the tone of this race a little bit, Susan. We heard a taste of some of those campaign ads there. I think it's fair to characterize a lot of the ads that have been out there in the Senate race as attack ads. Definitely a very dark tone in some of the pro-Ron Johnson, anti-Russ Feingold ones, some attacks going back. And then we've heard from candidate incumbent Ron Johnson. He has said in radio interviews he doesn't respect Russ Feingold. He's called him a phony. Russ Feingold has called it a kind of a hysterical last-ditch effort on Ron Johnson's part, some of his attacks. So what do you make of the tone in the Senate race at this point?
Well, I think the tone in Senate elections and elections in general over the past decade or so has been quite negative, and I think the tone that we're seeing in 2016 is particularly negative from the top of the ticket on down. So I'm not terribly surprised, given just how polarized the nation is and even the state of Wisconsin is, that the ads are quite negative on both sides.
Looking at a presidential election year, are voters out there looking carefully at the issue, the issues and the policy platforms of Senate candidates, or is this a lower information race than usual because of the presidential race, so maybe these ads are the one thing we have to go by?
Well, I think that what happens when you have any sort of election that's in the same year as the presidential election year, you have much less information being shared because the media is just not paying attention to the races as they would be if there had not been a presidential election going on. So I think you have a point there that sometimes these ads are the only information or part of a very limited information that voters are getting about various candidates.
One issue that whoever the senator is going to be will have to deal with is a Supreme Court opening. This is something that's been an issue in the race so far, with Merrick Garland not getting a vote in the U.S. Senate. We've seen some Republican U.S. Senate incumbents elsewhere in the country saying they might be looking at holding off a vote on a Supreme Court candidate for another 4 years, maybe, if Hillary Clinton wins this election. What do you make of the Supreme Court seats in the Senate race?
It's interesting because both candidates are talking about the importance of either of them getting elected for the purpose of that replacement on the Supreme Court. And frankly, it's pretty frightening that we're hearing people say that they would perhaps not hold a vote on a Supreme Court nominee for 4 more years. I mean, this is already, we're already in uncharted water. So I'm not glad to hear that. But I know that it's something that both candidates are using as a political tool to try to motivate their voters.
We've seen in Senate races around the country, not so much here in Wisconsin, the case where one candidate has the big gaffe or statement that really gets a lot of negative attention. It seems like both candidates have managed to avoid that kind of moment in this race. Is that the only thing that would really sway people, that would really move the needle a lot at this point, do you think?
I mean, I think voters' minds are fairly made up. I mean, like I said earlier, there are certain independents or people who are leaning one way or the other. But I think that when you have two candidates, Ron Johnson, who has held that seat now for 6 years, and Russ Feingold, who held it for multiple terms beforehand, they're pretty known quantities. And so I would assume that there's not a whole lot of movement there, but these ads and other things are going to be targeting that smaller percentage of people who may not be decided yet.
And are you watching election night returns with some of your students, Susan?
I'll probably be watching on my couch and hopefully go to bed early.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, it might be a late night for a lot of us. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She joined us to talk about the millions of dollars in ad spending in Wisconsin's Senate race a week out from the election.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, immigration is one of the big issues in this election cycle. We'll take a step back and look at the history of immigration in the United States and waves of anti-immigrant backlash.
Right now, there's a lot to disagree about in this year's presidential election, but one thing seems to bring Americans together. We want it to be over.
80% of likely voters say they're embarrassed by the presidential campaign, according to a Colby College Boston Globe poll earlier this month. Back in July, Pew Research found that about 60% of voters were, quote, worn out by so much coverage of the campaign and candidates. And the American Psychological Association found that just over half Americans see the election as a source of stress.
Our next guest is also counting the days until the elections are over. She wrote an editorial for the Appleton Post-Crescent, signed by the editorial board, called What We're Looking Forward to After the Election. And you can join us now at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling this election fatigue? Are you worn out and counting the days until it's all over? You can join us at 800-642-1234.
Sarah Riley joins us now. She's engagement editor at the Post-Crescent and a member of the editorial board there. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what is it, Sarah, you think about this election that has so many people wanting it to just be over?
It's just a nasty election. It's all around been a little bit tough to watch, and the coverage, like you said, is really intense this year. So for some reason, piecing it all together, I think everyone's feeling just really tired of it.
And you write in the piece that this election has, quote, left us sick to our stomachs. Is that how you're feeling here? We are just a week out from election, that sick to the stomach feeling?
Yeah, we wrote the editorial. It's a really kind of a lighthearted take on it. We had a conversation as an editorial board thinking, what were we going to write about? And obviously, we want to say something about the election. It's what everyone's talking about. And everything we came up with was sort of a little riff on what we were looking forward to actually when the election was over. So it was definitely a lighthearted take on it, and we're just talking about, you know, some of the things that we'll be happy to not see for a while after next week.
And we'll get into some of those fun things you're looking forward to. But, you know, the American Psychological Association, I mentioned their polling on this, and they recommended, hey, if you're feeling stressed out by the election, take a time out. Take some time off from coverage. Given that you work in the media like us, have you been able to do that, take a time out from watching the twists and turns?
You know, I find myself every little break that I have turning on CNN and watching to see what's going on, but I have this forced break every night because I have a four-year-old, and I can't have CNN on when my four-year-old's home. It's just kind of, I don't want to answer some questions that I might get, so parents out there, I think, can understand this. We've had this sort of forced break a little bit, so I'm happy to have that built into my life.
And that is one of the things on your looking forward to list, it sounds like, being able to watch the cable news channels again with kids in the room.
Yeah, I think people can relate to that. And again, you know, we're just having a little bit of fun with it. It is, you know, a very serious election. There's great issues out there to talk about. But for some reason, the coverage is just twisted in a way that hasn't left us feeling really good about it. So it's nice to I would definitely agree, you know, build in those breaks for yourself because you can get caught up in that cycle.
We're talking to Sarah Riley, engagement editor at the Appleton Post-Crescent, talking about people looking forward to the end of election season. She wrote an editorial signed by the editorial board there at the Post-Crescent, talking about things they're looking forward to when election season is over. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling stressed? Are you feeling fatigued? Are you feeling overwhelmed by this year's election season? Are you looking forward to it all being done? What are you looking forward to? And are you going to maybe make friends again with some of the people maybe you've fallen out of touch with because they're on the other side of the divide on social media? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Sarah, one of the items on the list, again, that I think is going to resonate with a lot of people is that you can, after the election, presumably RSVP for a family get-together, a dinner, and not have to worry about what kind of landmines are going to be in the room and whether you can actually talk to people without getting into an argument.
Yeah, I thought you might pick up on that one. Yeah, that was fun. We, you know, it's just cringeworthy. Thankfully, the timing of the holidays leaves us, you know, looking forward to it again because I swear if it was before the election, it would be I'd have to think twice about some family members being in the same room. You know, it's just a lot of, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it tends to get spread when people come together, and you know, everybody's got their side that they're on, so they really want to push for it. So family gatherings, yeah, those will get you. That really kind of gets under your skin after a while.
And this whole lighthearted piece you wrote on things to look forward to, I mean, is that part of how you're dealing with it, to try to think about fun things, what life will be like without the elections going on?
Yeah, I mean, watching a Packers game is a great escape, right? Until you hit the commercials, and then you're sucked back in. So looking forward to those times when we can watch, you know, anything we want to watch without seeing the tone of some of these political ads that we see.
Like you said, you know, you're a reporter in the media, on the editorial board, and a political junkie. This is the kind of stuff political junkies live for. It's the high holidays. It's the election season. And I wonder if you think we've seen races like this before, though, where instead of it being sort of a thrill ride, it kind of turns a corner and makes people just want to get off the ride altogether. Is this something kind of new?
Yeah, I think this is particularly a difficult one to get through. You know, there are a lot of fun things about it, if you can think about it that way. But just, I was kind of forcing myself to think about this too, and why is it not as fun this time around? But I went to, we host a Packers show every week called Clubhouse Live, and we have a huge costume party, which we had last night. No political costumes. You know, I popped into the hotel. They had a huge Halloween party. Didn't see anybody. You know, think of all the Sarah Palins that were out there several years ago. It's just, I think it's just a common thing that it's just, there's not a lot in there to have fun with this election. So, yeah, hoping for the next one is, you know, again, not to take a light-hearted tone about something that's so serious, but you got to have a little fun in life, too, and this one just leaves us cold.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Milwaukee. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you doing for a politics break?
Well, let me just say this. Like I told you, producer, I went on vacation from it all, but I'm going to say this. Of all the things to talk about with precious radio time, this is a waste of time.
All right, Jerry, we'll take you off the air there. We're having a lighthearted, fun conversation about the election and inviting callers to join in at 800-642-1234. Jerry, enjoy your election, your vacation after the election. And, Sarah, what do you think about that, taking a vacation after Election Day is done?
I'd be up for that. That sounds awesome.
And do you have anything like that planned, maybe a sabbatical to cleanse the palate for a day or two?
I don't. We were just talking today in the office. It's a little tense. The election season is always a very busy time at newspapers. It's really a fun time, but we were just having a conversation too today about, but maybe next Wednesday, maybe next Thursday, we'll all feel a little bit better and be able to joke around a little bit more. So, you know, it's just an odd time that we're looking forward to it after, because usually it's, you know, obviously the thrill of Election Day is just a great thing for us as journalists. No matter what happens, it's so fun to watch the twists and turns. Definitely looking forward to that, but looking forward to just a little maybe slice of calm coming back into our lives late next week.
Animal videos are something that is supposed to reduce stress. In specific, I guess, cat videos, which I guess can attest to their popularity. Is that something that you've tried? Does it work to actually, you know, you're covering the election, you're taking it all in, you're reading the latest news, and you break, and you watch a cat playing with a vacuum cleaner or something?
I am not even the hugest animal person, and I probably have watched more than I've ever watched in my life. You know, you just stop. Your brain resets for a second when you see those, like, puppies in costumes, whatever it is. Yeah, it's a little, that little mini mental break that's just noticeable this time around.
We've got an email from Alex in Milwaukee. Alex says she's planning a post-election party. No politics allowed. Just reconnecting with friends and neighbors. And that sounds like a great idea in a lot of ways. I mean, making those local connections again and seeing what's important in your own area, among your friends, neighbors, your community. That sounds like a pretty good approach, doesn't it, Sarah?
That sounds awesome. I'm just thinking, you know, go for a walk down your block and election signs stacked up, one house against the other, all over the board. It'll be nice when we can look at a house and maybe not make a judgment on what that person is all about based on the sign in front of their house, you know, on both sides of the equation. So, you know, it's great that people are involved, and of course we applaud that, but, you know, we also look forward to the time when we can have a little more common ground.
Do you think that it'll be as simple as we think it is? You know, there's election day, boom, it's over, and then suddenly all these divisions that seem so stark right now disappear? Or have we, you know, gone a little bit down this path where things that divide us seem pretty powerful and we have some work to do to get back to common ground?
I definitely see some work to do. I'm just thinking back on past, you know, when we're talking about family gatherings, that's not going to change. And that's, you know, that's part of fun of family and friends is being able to talk about these real issues. But yeah, I see the needle moving a little bit. You know, we said in this editorial, I truly hope for a reset the next time around for, you know, a little more civility. Everybody would love to focus on the issues more than who did what and who said what decades ago. So I fear that the needle's been moved a little bit, but I'm obviously hoping for the best that it'll be a little different next time.
Right, yeah, your wish list included the hope that one day we'll have a presidential election centered on the issues instead of whatever this is, end quote, and an end to the rancorous political debate in the nation. Hey, we can dream, quoting there again. So, Sarah, hoping for more pleasant politics, still contentious, I'm sure, but a more pleasant campaign next time around?
It would be awesome.
Well, it's a good place to leave it. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Riley. She's engagement editor and editorial board member for the Appleton Post-Crescent. She joined us to talk about an op-ed she wrote signed by the editorial board there. It's called What We're Looking Forward to After the Election.
Coming up after the news, we'll look back at the history of immigration in the United States. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. By the way, join us Sunday at 2 for the right to vote, from freed slaves and women's suffrage to today's debates over voter ID and felon enfranchisement. We trace the wild history of the right to vote in America. That's the right to vote Sunday afternoon at 2 here on the Ideas Network. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at a new study that shows students of color in particular are negatively impacted by the drinking culture at UW-Madison.
First, immigration has been a hot topic this election season. Here's an exchange from the third presidential debate. This is a couple weeks ago now, over immigration and border security. This starts with Donald Trump. You can also hear the voices of debate moderator Chris Wallace and Hillary Clinton.
Under her plan, you have open borders. You would have a disaster on trade, and you will have a disaster with your open borders.
What she doesn't say
is that President Obama has deported millions and millions of people just the way
Secretary
it is.
Clinton,
We will not have open borders.
Well,
that is a rank mischaracterization.
Secretary Clinton.
We will have secure borders, but we will also have reform.
Immigration's not a new issue in the United States. It's a large part of our nation's history, from the first immigrants who came to North America from Europe to the immigrants who are arriving in the United States today. Immigration has been both a source of pride and a source of controversy.
Cindy Yifan Cheng joins us now in the studio to talk about the history of immigration in the U.S. and the history of anti-immigrant backlash. She's an associate professor of history and Asian American studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is an ongoing tension. The nation relies on immigrants for the economy, for growth. A large majority of the population are descended from immigrants. But we have this tension about the impact of the latest wave of immigration in the country.
Yes, and it's definitely something that's rooted in history. I think the concept that you guys developed in terms of racial scapegoating is very, very applicable today as well. And what we start to see in terms of patterns is during times of economic recession, anti-immigrant backlash gets to be the height at its height. And historically speaking, this is something that we see happening with the first ever Federal Exclusion Act, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882.
Yeah, let's talk about that as an example. So 1882, I think, railroads and Chinese workers coming into the country to help build from the Pacific East to meet up with the Union Pacific. Huge part of that project, and then a backlash. Can you set the scene for us a little?
Oh, of course. The first important thing to understand is that in 1880, Chinese in the United States only made up 0.2% of the whole entire U.S. population. They were only 8% in California. So these numbers are quite small, and to generate a federal policy for their exclusion shows that there's larger ideologies at work. And in the 1870s, there was a major economic crisis. And there was also a tension within Congress to see whether Democrats or Republicans would regain, you know, control. And during this time, what they started to find as the unifying issue was Chinese exclusion. And workers during economic crisis would feel that the Chinese immigrants were taking their jobs away or undercutting wages. And I think the true alternative in thinking about it is that during this time, could workers organize outside of blood ties or ethnic ties? And if they saw their fellow Chinese workers as fellow workers, could they come together and take on the mantle of labor and challenge the capitalist system for why they're out of work? Talk about the greed of corporations and how that's occurring. But what we start to see is that instead of devoting their energy towards building an inter-ethnic coalition of workers, you start to see workers turning against each other. And here with United States race relations, right, with Chinese immigrants as non-white immigrants and also immigrants that were not allowed naturalized citizenship, you also see why immigrants become a very easy target because they have no political voice. It's very easy to target them because there's no political consequences for doing so. So that it became a national platform, even in states that have never seen a Chinese immigrant.
And we'll dig more into that story in a bit, but it seems like probably you could tell similar stories at various points about Irish immigrants to the United States, Eastern European, Latin America, and even African Americans, freed slaves, not actually immigrants, but a new addition to the paid labor force. Do we see similar tensions between, you know, do these workers unite together regardless of race, or are they divided along the lines of race or ethnicity?
Yes, exactly. And I think that what you start to see, especially in this period, right, is that it was mostly Irish workers not wanting to be at the bottom end of the totem pole. Dennis Kearney, you know, much of the labor organizers built their kind of platform and on Chinese exclusion. So you really start to see a tension between Irish workers and Chinese workers. And what they did was you start to see the formation of a particular racial capitalism where whiteness was deemed to have a bit more value or entitled to certain kinds of jobs over non-white immigrants. And I think that once again, even labor unionists during that time were critiquing the kind of anti-Chinese exclusion platform, saying that we really have to see each other as coming together as workers, right? And what is going to, the only way that our situation is going to be alleviated is if we critique the system. But just getting rid of these workers, it doesn't mean that their pay is automatically going to increase or their working conditions are going to get better. And it certainly, there were a lot of political cartoons that said, hey, if we get rid of the yellow, who's next? Is it green? To signal that it doesn't actually mean that Irish immigrants' lives were going to be increased because of it.
We're talking to Cindy Efen Cheng from UW-Madison. She's a professor of history there, looking at the history of immigration in the United States and anti-immigrant laws and backlash. Let's talk about, again, get back to this case study of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So there was this, you call it scapegoating. What ended up happening in terms of law? What changed?
Well, the United States passed its at first, prior to this, we have what we normally call a period of open immigration. And the United States, because of this, and this is where why Chinese exclusion has been so studied, it sets the pattern. It creates a particular political culture that in times of economic crisis, what are the actions that we believe can actually fix it? And so the number one thing is we've got to exclude immigrants. And so you have the first ever federal policy, which is actually 1875, which is the Page Act, which was to restrict Chinese women and Chinese contract workers. It wasn't reinforced shortly after. We have the first ever act that was enforced, 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which was to ban and bar all Chinese laborers from the United States. And it's the first ever federal legislation to name a particular racial group and class of people for purposes of exclusion. But the legacy of it is that in times of economic crisis, we can jump to the Great Depression. We can even jump to current times, right? That in the Great Depression, you will see another rise of anti-immigrant sentiment. And for the In the Great Depression is when we began to really actively restrict Latinos from the United States. But prior to that, the borders were fairly porous.
I want to add in the issue of security now. This is an issue big, obviously, since the September 11th attacks. Is there an analogy, though, you had in the era pre and post World War One, anarchist bombing attacks often linked to, rightly or wrongly, immigrant communities? Was that a factor in some of those specific targeted immigrant exclusion laws?
Oh, 100%. Definitely in World War One, and definitely as we go into the period that I study with the Smith Act, right, which is that radical ideologies like communism could never be homegrown. Radical ideologies are like foreigners and immigrants are always imported from abroad, right? And so this deeper sense of xenophobic sentiments, the fear of the foreign, it doesn't just apply to people, but also applies to ideas that workers could not be discontent with their particular situation. To discredit and undermine their critique of capitalism, their critique of big businesses, you immediately say, well, you're influenced by foreigners. And this way it undercuts the legitimacy of their discontent with their class struggle.
So looking at today now, we might look at a few different issues like border security because of fears of terrorism, worries about immigration as an economic issue. I've even seen rolled into it people worried about when Ebola came around, the idea that Ebola might be introduced by terrorist groups or accidentally via the southern border. Do we end up wrapping all these different elements into one common, I guess, fear of a contagion?
Yes, that's an excellent point. What we start to see is that the intersection of using labor to control, I mean, using immigration policies to control labor to as a way that we believe it actually will fix our recession, and the use of immigration policy as national security, we start to see the intersections. Taking the one about economic recession, for example, We've all been exposed to the news. We understand a lot of the fiscal crisis is related to both the dot-com boom, the subprime investments, and the bad banking. We understand the cause, right? And we understand what it led to a lot of people. Now, intellectually, we understand it. But why is it that the solution is Latino immigrants? How are Latino immigrants responsible for the greed of our financial industry and the subprime mortgages that they lended out? It doesn't make sense. But what happens is the pattern of history, such that we have an economic crisis, immediately we want to solve it. We think getting rid of Latinos is going to actually improve, but that our attention, it just distracts our attention from critiquing the corporate culture, corporate welfare, and what has been done, right? And that's one angle of it. But it bleeds to issue of national security, in that right now what we're starting to see is to instead of really spending our money on counter-terrorist programs and measures, what we have used is to use, again, immigration control. And there's so many literature, so many credible studies. And, for example, the Registration Act that required all Arab American, Middle Eastern Muslims to register following the September 11th attack, all male to register, not one person was found to be a terrorist. And what you find actually working is investment in international intelligence, international operations. But this constant racial profiling in the name of national security has actually created a very unsafe place in the United States to be, right? Where with racial profiling, with us looking at each other and thinking that we can tell a loyalty by visually seeing somebody, right? It is kind of the very analogous to the anti-communist hysteria of the early Cold War, where we think we're spying, we can spy on each other. And I think that's a very, very, very detrimental way of thinking about immigration policy as national security.
We're talking to historian Cindy Ifan Cheng now from UW-Madison, looking at the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash here in the United States.
And we're taking your calls right now, too, at 800-642-1234. Why do you think immigration is so important in this particular election cycle? And what do you think we can learn from the history of immigration in the United States? How has U.S. immigration touched your family? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now about the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash in the United States with Cindy Ifan Cheng.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your family's history with immigration? What role do you think immigration has played in U.S. history? And what do you think about what our guest is talking about, these cycles of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash, often following up on a big economic dislocation, whether that's the Depression of the 1870s, the 1930s, or the Great Recession we're just coming out of? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Cindy, looking at the economic issues again, I mean, there are divisions today in the Republican Party. In particular, there's a pro-business element that sees immigrants as having a big value for the economy. And then there's a strong element supporting Donald Trump now, saying, no, they're depressing wages for American workers. They're competing for often scarce jobs in communities. Is this something we've seen before?
Oh, yes, of course. And I think that this is... the issue here is, I would like to kind of unpack it in different levels, right? There's definitely the issue of wanting to use immigrants to work on things as a way not to pay workers a high wage and working conditions. That's definitely an issue, and there's no way of not saying that's a major issue. The question is, the solution, is it always to get rid of immigrants, or is a solution to also... Not only, you know, to also work with immigrants as fellow workers to contest the system, right? There's also this issue of wanting to see that they are a danger to undercutting. And I think here we have to also really be forthright, because it's not all immigrants that's being targeted. It's not all immigrants that's being a threat to the economy. It's been said very repeatedly, openly in media, that it's Latino immigrants in particular. Right. And it's not any job, anything specific. So it's just this unknown threat that they're going to come and take away particular jobs. It's not an industry. We're not. Are we talking about the tech industry? Are we talking about the agriculture industry? What are we actually specifically naming? And I think part of this lumping together becomes not just an anti-immigrant thing, but a very, you know, anti-Latino sentiment that's being bred.
Is there something different when it's the case? Maybe at one point Irish immigrants or European immigrants were targeted, but immigrants of color, people who, you know, you can look at them, first generation, second generation, third generation, and a sense that, oh, they look different. Does that dynamic play out differently then?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that what we see in terms of the anti-immigrant backlash that's going on today is this intersection of both the fear of the foreign, the xenophobia, and very different kinds of racist sentiments that's happening, right? And so I think that for non-white immigrants to fully understand what's going on, we have to think about anti-racist measures as well as anti-xenophobia, because it brings both of them together.
So what would anti-racist and anti-xenophobia measures look like, as you're mentioning there?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that these measures, in terms of if we were to really genuinely develop a fair immigration policy, we can't go back to attacking particular nations for being responsible for certain things without saying that is the reason where there's a large Latino immigration coming in the United States, is it because there's been a lot of recruiters from the United States who actively seek out these workers, right? That's the balanced view, right? A lot of times I think people think about balanced view and immigration debate to be there's good immigrants and bad immigrants. The balanced views are immigrants come for jobs, but the United States desperately recruit these workers for these workers, right? And so we have to kind of really... look at the broader policies, right? And then also how do we protect workers in the United States, right, from maintaining their wages and working conditions? We have to really develop these kinds of measures.
Talking to Cindy Efen Chang from UW-Madison. She's a historian there talking about immigrants and anti-immigrant backlash in American history. We'll go to a caller. We've got Diane on the line in Manitowoc. Diane, hi.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Diane?
Good. My question is, I feel very offensive when people use the term illegal aliens rather than illegal immigrants. And I was just wondering if this is the correct term for people to use the word aliens rather than immigrants. And I find it offensive. And I was just wondering, if you could talk about that.
Diane, thanks for the call. So people do argue over the language. Are we talking about illegal aliens, illegals, people say, or undocumented immigrants? I assume this isn't the first time we've argued about the language we use.
Yes, and thank you so much for that question and also for wanting to work out the complexities of what these kinds of languages mean. I do understand the difference between aliens and immigrants. Aliens just kind of mark people as greater foreign. But I think many of the debates also center around the word illegal. So that when we're referring to people, calling them illegal implies a dehumanization of who they are. So even though as a legal status, they may be illegal immigrants or aliens, when you refer to people, oftentimes people prefer the term undocumented immigrants, because referring the term undocumented suggests that they are still people, right? And there's nothing quote unquote illegal about who they are. They just are people here without documents.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Cindy, you've seen recurring patterns with multiple points in American history. Do you see anything particularly unique or different this time around here in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think in relation to the kind of election cycle in terms of the context and the opening segment that you guys aired is that we are not in an era talking about immigration reform. That has not been the dialogue. We are in an era of open anti-immigrant sentiment and baiting, really, to be able to state. I think what it's being modeled, right, is that it's the immigration debate is one area where you can say any generalized, negative, very hurtful and very racist things about non-white immigrants, and it's seen as justifiable or permissive. And I think that this is a very damaging thing to foster and to not understand the connection that it has in generating different hostile, intense environments currently that, you know, we have to see the connection. And I think that these kinds of very open, you know, very open anti-immigrant sentiment we have not seen it quite this intense in a bit.
So you've seen anti-immigrant sentiment rising after past economic downturns, dislocations in the United States. What has led to them receding in the past? Why do they go away, or do they go away? Do we just keep building on them?
I think they do go away when things start to get better and people are employed and they do not feel that their economic situation is threatened. Those times, then we start to celebrate the United States as a nation of indigenous populations and immigrants. Then we start to celebrate that the United States is built, you know, on the workers of First Nations people and immigrants. And then we kind of see ourselves as very generous in helping improve people's lives. But during times of economic downturn, I think when people's sense of economic situation is more precarious, I think instead of it's harder to critique the structural thing, and sometimes the powerlessness that people feel make them turn on people who are even less enfranchised than they are.
In 2016, as we wrap up, do you see that pendulum starting to swing back toward that celebration of immigration?
I think that, again, in this particular current election, what it's brought forward is that no, right? And I don't think it doesn't matter who gets elected. I think that kind of sentiment is so permissible and out in the open that it's going to be really interesting. And I, being with the university, my commitment is that through education, we can really understand how to, truly treat each other better.
We'll leave it there. Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you so much.
That's Cindy Yifan Cheng. She's Associate Professor of History and Asian American Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. She joined us on the air today to talk about the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash in the United States. Still time for you to share your thoughts on these topics. A lot to talk about there. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. That's a Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR if you can share your thoughts in 140 letters or less. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about our favorite Halloween candy, and we heard from a bunch of you about your favorite sweets.
We also heard about your least favorite candies and talked about ours. That got a lot of reaction. Jill on Facebook chimed in, let us know that she thinks the worst candy out there is Circus Peanuts. That's a contender.
Which we kind of have to agree
a
little bit.
I just like the texture as
a kid. And the color.
Yeah.
The color's not great.
I'm warming to Circus Peanuts.
No. I'm saying I don't
like
the color.
Oh, you don't like it. Oh, okay.
Well, but we may have taken things too far yesterday when we trash-talked Swedish fish. On Twitter, Jeremy writes, "Swedish fish are amazing. Why so much hate for the delicious gummies?" It's from Jeremy. And on Facebook, Sandy told us, "Food allergic kids like Swedish fish. It's one of the very few safe candies for Halloween."
Here's the biggie, though. Ian writes, "I used to love Central Time, but then you guys had to go and push your dislike of Swedish fish agenda tonight. How can I recommend the show to my friends, knowing how biased it is, biased against Swedish fish?" A little tongue-in-cheek, I hope. Ian, thanks a lot for sharing that. I'm gonna stand by the truth here. Swedish fish, not great. They're not fish. I don't know if they're even Swedish.
But we like fish, and we like Sweden. Ergo, we like Swedish fish.
Right, so we'll go out with our celebration of Swedish culture here on Central Time.